Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm happy to have as my guest Elizabeth McKenzie, the author of The Portable Veblen. It's published by the Penguin Press, and I found it to be a very funny and unusual book, and by the time it stopped being funny, it brought me nearly to a state of great anxiety for its characters, because the two major characters manufacture happiness. They don't really feel it. They feel obliged to feel it. Their parents have been so weird and so pressuring and so demanding that these two have become first-class people pleasers, and they just cannot say what's truly on their minds. I'm going to ask my guest, Elizabeth McKenzie, to read from the opening chapter of The Portable Veblen, and you'll get an idea how pleasantly nuts this book is. Here we go. This is Elizabeth McKenzie.
And the attachment. Huddled together on the last block of Tasso Street in a California town known as Palo Alto was a pair of humble bungalows, each one a plot in lilies. And in one lived a woman in the slim green spring of her life, and her name was Veblen Amundsen-Hovda. It was a rainy day in winter shortly after the new year. At the end of the street, a squirrel raked leaves on the banks of the San Francisquito Creek, looking for pale aged oak nuts from which the tannins had been leached by rain and dew. In muddy rain boots, a boy and a girl ran in circles, collecting acorns, throwing them, screaming with delight in the rain. Children did this every day, Veblen knew, scream in delight. The skin of the old year was crackling, coming apart, the sewers sweeping it away beneath the roads. Soon would come a change in the light, the brief, benign winter of Northern California, tilting to warmth and flowers. All signs that were usually cause for relief, yet Veblen felt troubled as if rushing toward a disaster. But was it of a personal nature or worldwide? She wanted to stop time. The waterway roared as frothy as a cauldron, a heaving jam of the year's broken brambles and debris. She watched the wind jerk the trees, quivering, scattering their litter. The creek roared, you see. Did water fret about madness? Did trees? With her walked a 34-year-old man named Paul Vreeland, tall and solid of build, branded head to toe in a forge-gray Patagonia jacket, indigo cords from J. Crew, and brown leather Vans that were showing flecks of mud. Under her raincoat, Veblen wore items of indeterminate make, possibly hand-cobbled, with black rubber boots. She was plain and mild in appearance, with hair the color of redwood bark, and eyes speckled like September leaves. They stopped at a mossy escarpment in a ring of eucalyptus, redwood, and oak, and a squirrel crept forward to spy. "Veb," the man said. "Yes?" "I've been insanely happy lately," he said, looking down. "Really?" She loved the idea of spending time with someone that happy, particularly if insanely. "Me too." "Tacos también tonight?" "Sure." "I knew you'd say sure." "I always say sure to tacos también." "That's good," he said, squeezing her hands, "to be in the habit of saying sure." She drew closer, sensing his touching nervousness. "You know that thing you do when you run out of a room after you've turned off the light?" he said. "You've seen me? It's very cute." "Oh, to be cute when one hasn't tried is nice. Remember when you showed me the shadow of the hummingbird on the curtain?" "Yeah." "I love that. I know, it was right in the middle, like it was framing itself." "And you know that thing you do when telemarketers call and you sort of retch like you're being strangled and hang up? You like that?" "I love it." He cleared his throat, looking down at the ground, not so much at the earth, but at his footing on it. "I'm very much in love with you. Will you marry me?" A velveteen shell came up from his pocket, opening with a crack like a walnut. In it gleamed a diamond so large it would be a pill to avoid for those who easily gag. "Oh, Paul, look, a squirrel's watching." But Paul wouldn't even turn, as if being watched by a squirrel meant nothing to him. "Oh my gosh," she said, examining the alien stone for which she'd never yearned. "It's so big. Won't I smash it into things? Won't I wreck it?" "Diamonds can't be smashed." "I can't wreck it?" she asked incredulously. "You can't wreck anything. You only make things great." Her body quickened like a tree in the wind. Later she would remember a filament that passed through her of being glad she had provided him happiness, but not really sure how she felt herself. "Yes," the man said. The squirrel emitted a screech. "Is that a yes?" Paul asked. She managed to say it. "Yes." Two human forms became as one as they advanced to the sidewalk, the route to the cottage on Tasso Street. Behind them, the squirrel made a few sharp sounds, as if to say he had significant doubts. As if to say, and she couldn't help translating it this way, there is a terrible alchemy coming.
That's Elizabeth McKenzie reading the opening section from her new novel, The Portable Veblen. Now, tell me, Elizabeth, why a squirrel?
Why not a squirrel? No, I realized one day that I could sit in my boring office day after day, and every day where I live, squirrels would look in the window at me, and they're wild animals, and they seem not to mind living around us, and they made me feel connected to the lost natural world somehow.
How deeply do you regret that loss?
Well, I've always looked for ways to have the experience of feeling like a pioneer within the confines of my life in this century and the last century. I gather that every generation for centuries past has felt that kind of loss too, for this lost chance at kind of facing, you know, the elements with the fruit of their own labor.
It's a fact of this book that the heroine's mom has named her Veblen, in part because she's studied the Norwegian-derived American economist Veblen. Thorsten Veblen coined the expression conspicuous consumption. And if there's one thing that young Veblen has been raised to disapprove of, is conspicuous consumption. That diamond as big as the Ritz that she's given, that's not her. So is it Paul's impulse to be impressive. If he's in medical school, he's going to be first in his class. He's going to invent something that will make his name forever in the future. These are people who really have very perverse relationships to American success. She hates it, and he feels that you can't live without it.
You're right, and I just want to point out as an aside that the Fitzgerald story, A Diamond as Big as the Ritz, it's a squirrel that leads to the discovery of the diamond.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Was that implicitly in there?
No, I only discovered it recently, but yeah, I thought it was perfect.
I'm talking to Elizabeth McKenzie. We're talking about a book called The Portable Veblen. Now, There is a book, not this one, called The Portable Veblen, which is a collection of Veblen's essays on poverty, on affliction. He was America's depressive economist. He was a pragmatist, and he knew, you know, what was happening to America. He lived in the first of America's golden extravaganzas, where the railroad barons were stealing money from everyone, destroying the land, destroying possibility, and he wanted to head it off at the pass. And this young woman, who's been named after him, has read The Portable Veblen, and she and the squirrels that warn her when she's making bad choices, she wants a different kind of America. So this is, in a way, as a lot of admiring readers have said, it's a screwball comedy about how to get these two characters separated from one another. Did you know that would be your
You mean the couple?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I knew early on that they were going to discover things about each other that they couldn't stand, as many real couples do when they get engaged. And then it's sort of like, well, what do you do with that? Do you continue on and get married, or do you, you know, there's that book Marriage Dead or Alive that she's reading in the novel, which is a real book by Adolf Guggenbuehl Craig, who was a Jungian analyst. And basically it's saying that you really have to face all of your inner demons before you join with someone else, and you can avoid that until you get married. But once you're married, that unleashes everything. And so it's not very romantic.
And one of the things for sure is that all of the demons get unleashed in this book. And there are what I would call a progression, like rounds in a boxing match. Now they're going to meet her parents. Oh, no. Now they're going to meet his parents, still worse. Now his parents are going to meet her parents. And all of these parents, would you say that they're unusual?
No, they seem completely normal to me.
Uh-huh. Are they like yours?
They are recognizable types to me. I've been surprised that people seem to think they're, you know, such monsters. But yeah, they seem normal to me. But, you know, I mean, every family seems to have some strange dynamics.
The boyfriend has been trained to be successful in a peculiar way. He has an older brother who is
developmentally disabled. Yeah.
And very envious of Paul. When Paul says he's going to marry Veblen, his brother Justin says, oh, I'm going to marry Veblen. Are you going to marry the same Veblen? No, I'm going to marry a smaller one. They have the desire not to hurt Justin's feelings, and so Justin, in his extremity, always gets away with everything you can think of. Okay, in other words, it seemed to me as I read, this book is life as it is, with the magical thinking stripped away from time to time, while we see these characters really battling to keep the shades of magical realism up all the time.
Yeah, the will to believe.
The will to believe, exactly. But still, there are scenes in which the characters are confronting each other. As soon as they finish, they're going to have to spend the next week apologizing. But you sit there going, oh, this is hilariously horrible. This is grotesque verisimilitude. This is what happens when families get together and the pressure can't be relieved. Well, Paul, who's under more pressure than anyone in the book, really, has invented something to relieve pressure. Will you tell about it, please?
Sure. It's called the pneumatic turbo skull punch.
The pneumatic turbo skull punch.
Yes.
What does it do?
Well, it's a device that medics could take into the field to perform a craniectomy or craniotomy on the spot if someone has, you know, been injured and suffered traumatic brain injury, because the sooner you relieve the pressure, the greater the chances for recovery. So I just had him invent this device that I'm not quite sure if it could really exist or not, but I don't see why not. And it's been taken up by a pharmaceutical company, and it's been placed on every purchase order for the Defense Department, and, you know, things are looking good for Paul, but he may have to compromise himself.
It's hilarious because, of course, we all do what our insides make us do, and so he invents a pressure-relieving device. It's sort of like a cranial hole puncher.
Right.
So that on the battlefield, faced with terrible craniac pressure, the brain has room to expand once this hole has been punched, and it's less likely for the person to go into a coma.
Exactly.
And lose mental capacity.
Right. And it's a procedure that's been performed, you know, since, you know, the Neanderthal days. So they find these holes punched in brains back then.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that really true?
Yeah,
though?
It's an ancient technique. Yeah.
Not just a novelist's ancient technique.
No.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Elizabeth McKenzie about her book, The Portable Veblen. We'll continue after this brief break.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Elizabeth McKenzie about her latest book, The Portable Veblen. It's published by Penguin Press. It's set in California. It follows a couple on the brink of the end of their engagement due to both dysfunction and success. Now, in another hilarious scene, the very wealthy great-great-great-granddaughter of the pharmaceutical company feels that she must do her duty and seduce Paul in order to get access to his incredible invention. Say the name of it again.
The pneumatic turbo skull punch.
And we see advertisements for this thing in the course of the book. The pneumatic turbo skull punch. It comes with accessories. He becomes aware that a razor is needed under certain circumstances.
Right.
In order to remove the
flap. Yeah. Yeah, the iodine swab. And, yeah.
Yes. And not only does she seduce him, but her son by a previous marriage. This is Cloris.
And Morris?
Yes, Cloris and Morris Huttmacher. They're the, you know, heirs of Huttmacher Pharmaceuticals. And they're going to release, we find out, this device. There's a loophole. And so having tested it on animals, They're going to avoid the tests on human beings. Eventually, little Morris, who loves the device, is going to try it on his mother. She's going to be the first.
Well, she's really mean, isn't she?
She's horrible, and so is the company. And somehow the book desires to find a middle ground for these people and give them back a life that's not a showplace life and a house that is pleasant to live in but not a mansion. It's a book attempting to recall the values of the 1960s and restore them to our time.
Veblen is both someone who appreciates the misfits and the underdogs and the outsiders, and yet also yearns for a certain solidarity with others. You know, her mother has really isolated her in her childhood, so she loves her mother despite that. But, you know, when, for example, when she learns that squirrels used to group together and run in packs of the millions across the open spaces of the country before there were roads and stuff like that, she takes great pleasure in that because of the solidarity. Like, if there was no reason they had to go. It wasn't to find another food source, for example. It was they just decided to do it. So things like that cheer her up.
And she likes the idea of finding others like herself. She is working on a project in which she's translating not just the works of Veblen, but memories of people who knew Veblen.
Right, any material she can find that should go into Norwegian and be part of this project, yeah.
Because she understands that Veblen was the prophet who, if followed, would have helped us avert the anti-community state that we're in now, where 1% has all the money and people strive to become members of that 1%.
It's so true. He was writing about this stuff in the after the gay 90s, and the theory of the leisure class came out in 1899, and then he started up again in the 20s during the Roaring 20s, and his stuff was so prescient. I mean, even then it was a problem.
Yeah, I mean, listen to that title, The Theory of the Leisure Class. In other words, a book that tells us how we got that way. And what an idea to take, essentially, the screwball comedy set up from movies of the 20s and the 30s and add to it the philosophy needed for us to make a change. As a reader, I don't go around wanting my characters to get together or to solve their problems. It's not the way I read. But because this is a philosophical comedy, these characters are capable of doing what they finally do. In the last 14 pages of the book, there are appendices, and we learn that, I won't give anything away, but we learn that a happy ending is achievable. Was it part of your program to save these people and give them a happy ending?
Actually, I thought it was going to have an unhappy ending for them for a lot of the book. I thought they were doomed. And I think in the same way that you kind of maybe try to make a relationship work in your personal life, you know, by coming to a better understanding of yourself and the things that set you off and that don't really have anything to do with the other person, I think I started to see that that was possible for these characters. So it moved in a new direction as I was writing it.
Childhood really is for you the hidden land of heart's desire. And remembering it allows you to remember how things ought to be. And then the writer part of you gets to work trying to figure out how to bring back the way things should be. Restorative fiction. Does that sound real to you? Do you have a version of that that you say to yourself?
I've never said it to myself quite like that, but I do think you're right. I think that I like to go back to things that weren't right at the time and see what could have been different.
You have children.
Yes.
How old are they?
Well, my oldest son is 27. He lives in Japan, and my younger one is 16. He's in high school.
Wow. Did you find yourself raising them so that the problems you faced as a younger woman were problems that they wouldn't have to face as they became adult?
I know that I was always aware that I was trying to be different from things I had experienced, yes.
Have you succeeded?
I hope so. I feel very close to both my children, so I think they feel close to me too.
I'm guessing that the relationship between raising children and inventing, developing, and giving characters adventures is closer in you than it is in most writers. I have the feeling that these characters, particularly Paul and Veblen, they're your kids. You want the best for them.
That makes sense to me. Yeah.
I've been talking to Elizabeth McKenzie, the author most recently of The Portable Veblen. I found the book fresh and chaotic and funny and thoughtful and philosophical in a way I have nothing to compare it to. It's a very enjoyable and surprising book, and I was immensely charmed by it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Portable Veblen at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, the magnificent David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.